Good evening, everyone. Welcome to, I guess, the reboot of Current Jewish Questions. This was a class series that we... Oh, I should announce the date. It is Wednesday, October 24th, for anyone paying attention, 2012. Current Jewish Questions was a series that we started on Sundays and switched to something else. And initially, it was, you know, stuff like ripped from the headlines and like things that were actually in the news. And I guess this time around, I want to expand it a little bit more of, you know, not just like, hey, there was a news article about this, though that certainly is going to come up later on. And to do things just more of contemporary questions and try to think of like some real practical issues that come up day to day that you might not think about, you know, there are any issues of Jewish law, but there actually are. I have a schedule of like what classes I'd like to do when, but I'm also free to shuffle it. So if there's any topic that you find particularly interesting that I can turn into a full class, let me know. Sometimes it could just be like a very simple question. I can answer it in a sentence. But if it's like something bigger, let me know. And again, for the people who come, it's more important than anything else. So given that, you know, this is a, you know, since the Stanton Street Shul is, you know, pretty, you know, one of the things it's known for is its artwork, and particularly the mazalot. And we do have quite a few artists here. Wanted to talk about the halachot of art, or at least some of them. And I also had some questions with the paintings that were just put up down here. And then downstairs, it's part of a fundraising thing. So all of the paintings down here are interpretations of the mazalot that are upstairs. And all the ones downstairs are done by members of the community, which is really fascinating when you look down and see the quality of what's here. So for today's class, at least, I want to say that I'm not... You know, this isn't going to be a psak class. This isn't one where, you know, I'm going to give a, you know, definitive answer to any specific question. Sometimes I'd say what I think, but at least to go through, well, what can be some of the issues? A very important distinction that you might hear is between halacha and psak. Halacha is the general rule of things. Psak is someone asks you a specific question, what's the specific answer? And psak is a little bit trickier, because when someone asks, it would, like, some people might even make a distinction between case law and code law. If anyone, like you've got something that's in the books, but if someone has a question right in front of you, how do you make that snap judgment? So I just want to go through some of, at least, the issues that come up and some of the sources for those issues. And any questions that do come up should really be handled on a case-by-case basis, because there could be a whole bunch of mitigating factors that, I mean, either don't appear, that aren't going to appear in these Gemaras, but might appear in others. All right? Okay, so for those who haven't been here before, for translations, I usually like to go around and have people read. Everything's translated in English. For, you know, anything Bible I got from Bible Gateway, usually is a decent translation, sometimes not, and I'll point that out. Anything from the Talmud is from the Cincinnos translation, mostly because I can copy and paste. So if there's wacky English, that's that reason. Other things like Rambam, unless they happen to have the English translation of the Rambam for that volume, is my own translation. Or Shulchan Aruch is going to be my translation, in which case, completely my fault, as are all typos and other things. So, do you start us off with a first source here? This is Exodus 20:20, and it's an important verse because this is going to be sort of the biblical basis for the first section here on laws regarding creating art.
Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold.
Okay, pretty straightforward right there. But what does that mean in terms of halacha? And this is going to get explained. So, I mean, sometimes when you have a biblical verse, the sages will interpret it explicitly. Other times, it'll just come out more, you know, secondarily. So, this is, take the next source too. This is Gemara Rosh Hashanah 24a, 24b. 24 being the page number, A and B being the sides. The thing in the all caps here is how Cincinno does the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a compilation of rabbinic literature from the, you know, Second Temple period and a little bit afterwards into one, I don't want to say volume, but at least, you know, condensed into one edition. Yeah, well, one edition, I suppose. And the Gemara, the Talmud, are extrapolations based on the Mishnah. The Mishnah was initially done very tersely so that it was easy to remember. And the way that a Gemara is written is you have the Mishnah, then you've got a lot of sometimes commentary off of the Gemara and discussions based off of what was discussed in the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. All right, and yeah, that's the really, really short intro to Talmud. So, go ahead.
Okay. Mishnah, Rabbi Gamliel used to have a diagram of phases of the moon on a tablet hung on the wall on his upper chamber, and he used to show them to the unlearned and say, did it look like this or this?
So to explain, well, actually, let's ask here. Does anyone know, like, why would he have the phases of the moon on his wall?
Rosh Chodesh.
Yeah, Rosh Chodesh. Back in the day, before they had calendars, in order for there to be, like, a new moon, every single month, witnesses would have to come and testify, this is what I saw. And if it did, in fact, you know, meet the new moon, they'd say, oh, it's the new moon. And then, you know, calculate, and they'd send out, you know, this whole smoke signal chain about, hey, yeah, the new moon was decided, the new moon was decided. So what Rabban Gamliel had was, you know, I mean, you can imagine, like, you ask people, can you describe it, right? Then you have to go through it all the time. But when you have a chart, it's like almost showing a lineup. Right? It's like, which one did it look like here? It's like, this one? Oh. And, like, you don't tell them necessarily what the halach is. You just say, you know, how did the moon look? It's like, oh, look like that. Okay. So that helps. But it can get a little bit complicated. Continue in the Gemara.
Is this allowed, seeing that it is written, you shall not make with me, which we interrupt. You shall not make...
Interpret.
Interpret. Excuse me. You shall not make the likeness of my attendants. Abaye replied, the Torah forbade only those attendants of which it is possible to make copies, as it has been taught. A man may not make a house in the form of the temple, or an exedra.
Yeah, it's a card base. I had to look up Wikipedia for that, and the Wikipedia translation made even less sense. It seems to be like a raised type of engraving on something. Again, that might be a bad translation. That I had to look up in Wikipedia, because I did not know what that was, and I can't translate exedra that well.
Okay.
Yeah.
A man may not take a house in the form of the temple, or an exedra in the form of the temple hall, or a court corresponding to the temple court, or a table corresponding to the sacred table, or a candlestick corresponding to the sacred candlestick. But he may make one with five or six or eight lamps, but with seven he should not make, even of other metals, since a candlestick of other metals besides gold would have been permissible in the temple. Rabbi Jose ben Yehuda said, he should not make one of even wood, this being the way in which the kings of the house of Hasmoneans.
Yes, responsible for Hanukkah.
Okay. House of the Hasmoneim made it. When they first recaptured the temple from the Syrians and were still too poor to provide a gold candlestick, they say to him, can you adduce this as a proof? The spits, the branches of a candlestick, so-called because they had no ornaments, were of iron, and they overlaid them with tin. When they grew richer, they made them of silver. When they grew richer still, they made them of gold.
I should point out here that when I put stuff in brackets, those are actually footnotes from the Cincino that are often used to extrapolate on certain things in the text that might not be apparent. Mm-hmm. All right, so here, you've got one, the problem is, the Derasha that's going to be explained in the next paragraph, what does it mean, do not make any gods alongside me, is interpreted to mean, lo ta'asun kidmut shemashai, that you cannot make any images, or at least any forms, of my attendants. Meaning the assumption, initially, is that even making a picture of the moon is biblically prohibited, because it is one of the attendants of God. The explanation, at least according to Abaye, is no. It only applies to certain things that you can actually make a real copy. No one can make an actual copy of the moon, right? No one can make a life-sized copy of the moon. I mean, I doubt that's even physically possible today without screwing up the gravity, right? So according to Abaye, that's not a problem. Whereas it would be a problem making a bunch of these other things. Now notice what he said about the menorah, right? You shouldn't make it out of seven because it's like what was in the temple. So in terms of even artistically, right, you have certain limitations about what you're allowed to make because it's too close to what's in the temple. Like, you'll notice that menorah over there in the back. How many things does it have? I know the light's not on, so it's hard to see.
Six.
Yes, it does have six. Your Chanukiah has how many?
Eight.
Well, nine, technically, if you count the Shamash, right? But you don't find anything with seven. Why? At least, you know, this seems to be the reason behind it, because you don't want it to look exactly like what's in the temple, which also means, and that's certainly for a ritualistic purpose, but you've got other things here about, you know, making certain adornments itself seem to be problematic. Okay, so far?
So the menorah in the temple were eight?
I think it was seven. I don't know what they did with the shamus thing. I'd have to, we've got the pictures of that in the Ari Kaplan, the different versions. Should you take the next paragraph, Laura?
I noticed that you wrote Hebrew instead of Aramaic, right?
Where?
I mean, your translation of the Gemara was Hebrew, no?
The translation is all Cincino. I do this to, I copy and paste this. Like that's, yeah, for me to sit and try translating the Gemara on my own just takes way, way too long. It's much easier to copy and paste and see, you know, and correct if necessary.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm lazy. What can I say?
Well, I mean, it's easier for me though.
Yeah, well.
Sorry.
We'll look at that. Okay. Should I read it in English?
Yes, please.
But it is allowed to make likeness of attendance. Of which it is impossible to make copies.
Is it allowed? Meaning it's questioning.
Abaye's
statement was, if you can't make a direct copy of it, then it's okay. But the question is, wait a second, but is that really true, that if you can't make a copy of it, it's okay?
Okay. Seeing that it has been taught, ye shall not make with me. This implies, ye shall not make the likeness of my attendants who minister before me on high. Abaye replied, the Torah forbade only the likeness of four faces.
Yeah, you're referring to a pasuk in Yechezkel. I can't get into that right now. Just let that be for right now. That'll take too long to get into.
Only the likeness of four faces altogether. If that is so, the portrait of a human being by himself should be allowed. Why then has it been taught? All portraits are allowed, save the portrait of man. Rav Chuna, the son of Rav Idi, replied, from a discourse of Rabbi and learnt, you shall not make with me. Implies, ye shall not make me. And since man was made in God's image from Bereishit, the reproduction of the human face is not allowed.
That last connection, by the way, should add for anyone listening, is from Cincino. That's not the actual Gemara here, but the drush is lo ta'asun oti means lo ta'asun oti, that there seems to be some connection. I mean, it seems like a weird connection, that because, like, man somehow created the image of God, if you create the image of man, then therefore you're creating the image of God. Mm-hmm. It seems to be the logic of the Gemara. But then it would also mean not actually reproducing. I mean, the way he translates here is reproducing human face. And we'll get into a little bit later about different media of, you know, paintings versus sculptures and the like, you know, two-dimensional versus three-dimensional, like things like that. Right. But this is a pretty big deal for art if you're limited where you can actually do a human face.
Yeah.
All right. For pretty much anything. You know, so even if you want to say, you know, like not do the copies, well, you know, there's that. Can you take the next one, John?
Sure. Still are the other attendants permitted, seeing that it has been taught, ye shall not make with me. Ye shall not make the likeness of my attendants who serve before me on high, such as Ophanim and Seraphim, and holy
Chayot,
and ministering angels? Question mark. Of higher reply.
Well, because the question is, but didn't we learn this other source that said, hey, there are a bunch of things that you're specifically not allowed to do.
Right. Abaye replied, the Torah forbade only the attendants in the upper sphere, in the seventh heaven. But are those in the lower sphere, the second heaven and the sun and the moon, permitted? Has it not been taught which are in the heaven, this brings under the rule the sun, the moon, the stars, and the constellations above, quotation marks. This brings under the rule the ministering angels. That statement refers to the prohibition of making a likeness for serving them.
So there seems to be a distinction here between. So first of all, I said, well, you've got an upper sphere and a lower sphere. So the upper sphere seems to be universally prohibited, no pun intended, and the lower sphere seems to be okay unless you are planning on worshiping them. Which should seem kind of straightforward, but at least now you also see what's, you know, at least some of the concern that you have here, right? Of, you know, the purpose of worshiping. But continue with the next paragraph.
Okay. If for serving, then the tiniest worm should also be prohibited. Yes, that is so. As it has been taught, which are in the earth, this brings under the rule mountains, hills, seas, rivers, streams, and valleys. Beneath this brings under the rule the tiniest worm.
So if you want to make a sculpture of a worm because you want to worship it, that's bad. Not allowed to do that. But otherwise it seems okay. Right? But, or at least, you know, for just purely artistic purposes. Nothing. Next one. But is the mere making allowed? Has it not been taught? You shall not make with me, shall not make the likeness of my attendants who minister before me, such as the sun, the moon, the stars, and constellations. Rabbi Gamliel's case was different because others, non-Jews, made it for him. But what of Rav Judah, who had a figure on a seal, which others had made for him? And yet Samuel said to him, Shinina, which means you clever person, meaning sharp-toothed, put out that fellow's eye, meaning deface the image. This shows that, in fact, had been made by others who did not render it permissible. In that case, the shield was projecting, and Samuel forbade it, so that it should not arouse suspicion. that he used it for idolatrous purposes. It has been taught, a ring of which the seal projects must not be worn on the finger, but is permitted to sign with it. If the seal is sunk in, it is permitted to wear it, but forbidden to sign with it. But does it matter if we do arouse suspicion? Was there not a synagogue which, quote, moved and settled in Naharda? Rashi says that according to legend, this synagogue was originally built by King Yechoniah, with stones brought from Jerusalem, and it was a statue of a king. Rav and Shmuel and the father of Samuel used to go to pray and were not afraid of arousing suspicion. Where a whole body of persons is concerned, it is different. But Rav Gamliel was an individual. Since he was the Nasi, the head of the court, a large company was always with him. If you like, I can say that it was drawn in sections, so it was not a complete likeness. Or you can say that he did it for the purposes of study. As it is written, "Thou shalt not learn to do," which implies that you may learn to understand and teach. So in this last paragraph, you have a few more details and a whole lot more dispensations. Did anyone pick up what some of them were? Doesn't have to be in order. Well, first off, we've got the main concern about avodah zarah, about doing this stuff for idolatry, right? So what are some of the dispensations that we have in this paragraph here, at least hypothesized that seem to take? Because we're going to see all these in the later halachic authorities. All right, one, who's making it? Jew or non-Jew? It seems to be more of an issue if a Jew makes it than if a non-Jew makes it. That's in that first one up there. Okay. Two, matter of protruding. This is where you have the three-dimensional one or not, and where he has the difference of if it's raised versus if it's indented, because apparently if it's raised, it's considered, you know, either closer to idolatry than not. You've got the matter of it being in public, right? That certain things done in public, you have no suspicion of it being used for idolatry. And finally, doing it for the purposes of teaching, meaning for educational purposes, there seems to be somewhat of a dispensation, right? So you go back to Rabban Gamliel and having the thing on his wall. Why did he have the faces of the moon, right? Clearly it wasn't for idolatrous purposes. He was trying to train people or like to teach them, hey, here's what the moon looks like, right? So that's the section of the Gemara. You'll notice, if, you know, people unfamiliar with the Gemara, how there's a lot of dialectic. There's a lot of give and take. Fast forward, you know, a few hundred years, we'll get to Maimonides, who condenses it into more coherent halachic statements. So if you take us to Avodah Zarah 3:10.
Quick question. You said one of those, protrusion, right?
That yes.
Was one of the, so why would that, I understand, like, you know, having it in public and having it for education. What was the difference there?
I think the difference is if something is more in public, if things are protruding, it seems like it's more of an actual statue type. Notice the distinction here. They make a distinction here with whether or not it can be used like worn, mm-hmm. or used as a signet and used as a steel and as a stamp. Mm-hmm. The concern, I would suppose, if it's protruding, meaning it's three-dimensional, it's going to look more like a statue type of thing.
I see. Okay.
And, you know, but if I use it as a seal, I'm not recreating it, I'm doing an indentation. On the other hand, let's say my ring has an indentation of a human face. Right? Let's say, instead of it being, like, normally when you carve something out, you carve everything around it.
Right?
Right? So that it's a little bit raised.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But let's say I have the picture of a face, and, you know,
indented.
Exactly, it's indented, and I use that to seal. So that, it says, you're not allowed to do. Why?
Because then it would be raised.
Bingo! Because what you're going to be creating is a three-dimensional raised image, and that's no good. Right? We'll see that side. Do Rambam... Yeah.
If it's not in the face, in the shape of a face, how is it not still a 3D raised? Or is it just the distinction that it's a face versus...
It's particularly a face. I mean, you're not just talking about, like, a random sign. Like, you know, right. I know you want to put, like, an infinity symbol or whatnot. There's no, you know, there's nothing close to that, like, that's idolatrous. There's something, or even, I mean, you can actually say there are two other issues here. You know, one is the biblical prohibition, at least as it's interpreted, of don't make certain images at all. And then you've got another concern about making something that might be used for worshiping. So maybe by having it as a three-dimensional rendering, it's more closer to actually making an image of it as opposed to carving something out, which isn't. That's more of a negative image, if anyone knows graphics. It's like, you know, the inverse thing. So you really have two of those issues at stake, because the biblical verse that's cited at the very beginning is not directly connected to idolatry. It's something that's a little bit separate, even though they're related.
So now, the question is, like, with a ring, like, let's say you said, so it seems to say that if the ring was protruding, that was a little better, because anything that any symbol that it made would
no.
be...
No, so what the Gemara says here, you can, if it's protruding, mm-hmm. you're not allowed to wear it, but you can use it to sign.
I see, okay.
But if it's the other way, you can use it to wear, but you can't use it to sign.
Okay, right. I got
That's
you.
It.
I got
Either
you.
Way, it can't be 3D. That's basically...
Well, you can't use it fully for 3D. Right. But, I mean, there are other ways of doing it, meaning if it's broken up such that it's not a real picture of a face... Right? It seems to be like the closest it is, like, because if you take some artistic liberties, you know, you have a little better luck doing that, because it's like, oh, it's not really looking like a face.
And this is just, I mean, I know you said this is not sackcloth, but like, this is just Gamliel's take on it? Is there like an answer?
Well, let's get to the Rambam. I mean, we get to like the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, which I believe I quoted, are the ones that are actually used, you know,
in, like,
for halacha l'maaseh.
Yeah.
Like, well, Rambam less so. I mean, people like citing the Rambam, but very few people actually paskin straight from the Rambam. Often the Shulchan Aruch says what the Rambam says, but when it comes to the specific details, you're going to find a huge range of opinions on this when you get to specific questions. All right? So, take it. Rambam Avodah Zarah 3:10.
It is forbidden to create decorative forms, even if not idolatrous, for it is written, "Do not make any gods to be alongside me," which means to say forms of silver and gold, which are only for decorative purposes, such that people would not mistake them and compare them to idols.
Right, so here Rambam actually connects the two. He says there's this biblical verse for it, but the reason for the biblical verse is that people shouldn't confuse them. Right, so he's making that connection logically here. Please, if anyone knows the Hebrew, feel free to read along in the Hebrew and correct my translation if you think I did it imprecisely. Yeah.
And there is no prohibition to make an image except for humans, and therefore we do not make forms of a human... not with wood, plaster, or stone.
And I also can't type. Sorry.
And this is where the forms is protruding.
Form.
Such that a sculpture, basin in a washroom, and the like, and if he fashions it, he is lashed.
Meaning he violates a biblical commandment.
But if it is sunk, or if the image...
Sunk in, meaning indented.
Mm-hmm. But like, if it is sunk in.
Yeah.
Okay. But if it is sunken, or images of signs, such as images on tablets or embroidered, these are permitted.
Okay.
All right. All right, so we have, you know, so some pretty much what we said before. Mm-hmm. Next one, 3:11.
A ring which has a seal of a man, if it is raised, it is forbidden to wear, but permitted to use it as a seal. And if the image is engraved, it is permitted to wear it, but forbidden to use it as a seal, for it will create a raised image. Also, it is forbidden to create forms of the sun, moon, stars, constellation, and angels. For it is written, "Do not make alongside me," meaning do not make images of my agents which operate before Most High. And even on a board, images of animals or other living things aside from men, and plants and grass and the like, are permitted to draw even if it is raised.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So he actually is taking it all the way through. Like, you as a Jew are not allowed to make a whole bunch of images here. At least, you know, raised. And certain things, even if they're... certain things are permitted even if raised. Like, plants don't really count. But everything else, it seems there's a really big issue with sculpting in particular. Okay. I think last one, the Shulchan Aruch. Wow.
What is board? Like, what does it mean on a board?
I think it just...
is it like a luach?
Well, that's actually the word used here. That's how I tried translating it. Yeah.
Okay.
Afilu al haluach is how the Rambam is Rambam's word. So that's
okay.
The best
that's
I could
fair.
Come up with. All right. Okay. For this is Shulchan Aruch Yerideah 141:4. So you see in the section of Yerideah, for the stuff that doesn't fit in day-to-day stuff, most of it gets put in Yerideah, including laws of idolatry.
Okay. It is forbidden to create forms of things connected to the divine, such as the four faces altogether, and so to the images of the seraphs and the ministering angels and of man alone. All of these are forbidden to make for decorative purposes, and if a non-Jew made them, it is forbidden to display them. Rambam, at any rate, if one finds them, they are permitted aside from the sun and the moon, for it is normal for idolaters to worship them, or that there is proof it was made to be worshipped. In which case, all forms are forbidden, as we explained in the beginning of the chapter. When was this said? With items which are raised. But if it's engraved, such as embroidery or painted on the wall with signs, it is permitted to make. And the image of the sun, moon, and stars are forbidden, whether they are raised or engraved. And if they are for educational purposes, it is permitted, even if it is raised.
It is all permitted, right? So there's nothing really, you know, new with this section here. I mean, it seems to be following pretty much what the Rambam said. Mm-hmm. So in this first section, in terms of like art, painting seems to be okay, since, you know, even though technically, yes, painting is three-dimensional, right? Because you're putting paint on something that's slightly raised. You know, it seems, you know, fine. Well, at least, you know, based on this, you're generally better off for most things. Just don't get too heavenly. But if you're a sculptor, you're in trouble. And funny little tidbit here. If anyone goes to YU on the fourth floor, did you go to YU?
No.
Okay. So the fourth floor of YU has, which in, I shouldn't say why, because it has a few buildings, in Belfer Hall, which is the super big, tall building in Washington Heights. Fourth floor, Cy Sims School of Business had a bust of Cy Sims that was made, I believe, by his niece, if I'm remembering correctly. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't on campus when this was actually donated. I think it was like in 94 or something like that. And, you know, from what I heard, people did have issues with that, because you have a Jewish school with a bust that seems somewhat to have been forbidden to be made, especially by someone who I would assume would be Jewish. And yet it was on display there. Now, I don't know if the university had time. I would guess that it was done without the university's knowledge, or at least not without, you know, Rabbi Lamb would have been in charge there. I doubt anyone asked Rabbi Lamb first, like, hey, is this a good idea? Can we do this? But, you know, that's when you get the PSOC questions coming in, where if you've got a major donor and someone in the family decides to donate a bust and to display it, and it's already been done, what do you do, right? I'm sure if anyone asked, hey, can we do this? You'd say no, but once it's already done, what are you supposed to do with this thing? At any rate, it's there, though from what I heard, a lot of people were not happy about that. I wonder if it's still there. Anyway, if anyone's in Washington Heights again, take a ride up to the fourth floor of Belfer Hall and see if it is, in fact, still standing. Yeah, nice little tidbit. Anyway, so that's in terms of creating art, right? Again, something you wouldn't think, like, should be a problem. Another one that comes up, shockingly, you know, it's something which, you know, we're going to see in a moment, you know, is an issue, but it's also roundly ignored. And that is the use of verses for art. In fact, one of the artists down here asked, when she was painting one of the paintings, she was like, how should she write a certain pasuk? And I actually said, you shouldn't. Here's why. So it's initially, it's a Gemara in Gittin, 60a. Abai asked Rabba, Abai asked Rabba, is it permitted to write out a scroll containing a passage for a child to learn from? This is a problem alike for one who holds that the Torah was transmitted to Moses scroll by scroll, and for one who holds that the Torah was transmitted entire, meaning all at once. It is a problem for one who holds that the Torah was transmitted scroll by scroll. Since it was transmitted scroll by scroll, we may also write separate scrolls. Or do we say that since it has all been joined together, it must remain so? It is equally a problem for those who hold that the Torah is transmitted entire. Since it was transmitted entire, is it improper to write separate scrolls? Or do we say that we cannot dispense with this? Do we write them? Meaning, since you need to do it at some point, like you have to do something. So he replied, quote, we do not write. What is the reason? Because we do not write. It is a great Talmudic answer here. I first found that. I was like, what? You're reading this, and let me just find this in the Hebrew. It says here, Amarle ein kotvin, uma ta'am lefi she'ein kotvin. It's wonderful. So the answer is, we don't because we say so, effectively. It's like, you don't write out... Well, I don't know a better way of translating that. It's like, we don't do it because we don't do it. Uh-huh. And that's the more literal translation. Oh, you know, we don't write it because we don't write it. There you go. Right. And then it gives, I'll skip a bit here, but then it gives an example about having a certain passage written and being able to use it to be copied for educational purposes, like for the Sota. I'll skip down to four lines from about the last word. On this five lines, on this point, Tanaim differ. As we were taught, a scroll should not be written for a child to learn from. If, however, it is the intention of the writer to complete it, he may do so. Mm-hmm. Rav Judah said he may write from Bereshit, the story of the generation of the flood, or in the priest's law up to when it came to pass on the eighth day. So there's a discussion here about how much of the Torah that you're allowed to write, meaning scribally, independent of it being a full scroll. Why is this important? I'll use here Rambam, Maimonides, in addition to having written the Mishneh Torah, the Code Compendium, also wrote or at least we have of his several responsa, where someone asked him a question and he gave a halachic answer. So regarding a talit, which someone chose to use for tzitzit, and he wishes to make the mitzvah nicer by skillfully embroidering the edge with biblical verses and to write God's name with three yuds. And an official in the city protested what he did and said that it was done, protested what he did and said that it is forbidden to wear this talit. Teach my master, is this thing which was done proper and permitted to followers, is it a sin? And if it is a sin, what is the law regarding this talit, which is the embroidering of biblical verses? What is what is obligated with this, which is permitted by the city official and not accepted? Teach us this law and your world will be double from heaven. So the question is, specifically, are you allowed to embroider verses on a talit? Something that is quite common today. Rambam's answer, the answer to this action is a sin and is not permitted at all. And this prohibition from our perspective is from two reasons. The first one is that it's not permitted to write individual biblical verses, but rather three letters alone and no more. Even when it is permitted to write a section for a child to teach, this was only permitted for the purposes of education, for the Torah was not given to be written section by section, and certainly not verse by verse. And even if someone thinks that this prohibition is only good for writing with ink and the like, but not for carving or wood and gold and the like, or embroidering in the garments is permitted, know that there is no distinction between writing and embroidering. Now, I put an ellipsis here because I skipped out a large chunk of the Rambam, right? So the reason why, according to Rambam, it can't be used for decorative purposes is because writing, you know, when you have the pasuk, when you're writing the Sefer Torah, it's supposed to be, like, when you write psukim, it's supposed to be specifically for the Sefer Torah, not for any other purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, I should also say here, before we get to the other issues, the other issue he has, in terms of, like he said, there were two reasons. The other reason why he said is you are not allowed to have verses embroidered on a talit is that according to Jewish law, you're allowed to enter a bathroom wearing a talit, right, with allowing to wear the fringes. I know it is common practice in most synagogues for people to take off their talit before they go to the bathroom. No one takes off their tzitzit before they go into the bathroom, and it's the same thing,
yeah.
Right? Halachically, you're fine if you do so, as opposed to, say, tefillin, which can't go in because they actually have God's name written in them, and that's kind of Rambam's point. Since, you know, if wearing tefillin, you know that you can't enter a bathroom. And keep in mind, you can argue that the bathrooms in his day are different than our day, because in their day, they were outhouses. Today, we've got really nice modern plumbing, right? So let's assume that our bathrooms have the same law. All right, since, like, you know, oh, tefillin, these don't go in, but a talit, you might be used to going in. But if you have God's name or, like, some verse written on the back, that you can't do. So that's his second reason why he gave. I just took it out here because I didn't want to spend time in the text on it. Right. Now, if this is the case, right, how could you ever write any verse? Right? I mean, the Gemara has lots of biblical verses being cited. How do you write biblical verses in letters? Now, you could say, oh, those are all for educational purposes, you know, which might be true. Rama makes also a very important distinction here that would have taken too long to copy and translate, and that is the different types of script. Does everyone know the different types of scripts?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Like Rashi, like that kind of thing, or like
kind of. I mean, yeah. You're right. And that's actually a very great point there about Rashi script. But yes, Rashi. Here, and pass this around for anyone who hasn't seen. You'll notice that you've got block lettering up here. That's like the font. Yeah, I can use font, and people will understand what it means now. Yeah. So the font up here is the ksav, as we're going to use here. Think of it as a font. Right? This is all blocky. This down here is Rashi. It's more scripty. As far as I know, Rashi did not come up with Rashi script, but that's just, you know, how it's known. It's Rashi. But it looks really different, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So that's a different one. The Sefer Torah that we know initially was not written in the block letters that we know it today. What we have today is something called Kitav Ashuri, which means Assyrian script. Before that, you had Kitav Ivri, which is more of a what's the good translation for Hebrew? I mean Hebrew, I suppose. I'm blanking on the academic term for it. But it was written more as a cuneiform script, which is more... What?
Semitic.
Semitic. I like that. But it was written more as a cuneiform, meaning instead of like blocks, it was more of like lines, you know, as opposed to something real blocky. So Maimonides does make that distinction of between, you know, where this stuff applies, whether or not it's like the block lettering like you have in the Sefer Torah or a regular script. Because if the real concern, based on the Gemara, is writing scrolls and writing verses, if you're writing it in a different sort of script, like, say, Rashi script, that's not how a Sefer Torah is written. So it's clear that you're not doing it to partially write a Sefer Torah. Okay? Right? Because you're going to be using it in a different font. Now, the question today, and I asked, you know, I tried getting the answer is, you know, does this apply to other assorted fonts? Like, the font that I use for the Hebrew here is David. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the name of the Hebrew font. Does that count today for these purposes of decoration or Savashuri or whatnot? And the question for me actually did come up when, you know, back in the day when I was still like making flyers, right? Using Hebrew script and like, you want to use Pesukim. Like, can you do that? Like, so I didn't have really a straight answer. Or like, would putting it in italics, you know, change it enough? Or other things like Karin. But, you know, some other issues where this does in fact come up. In Israel, in Mea Shearim, one of the popular places that all yeshivas and seminary students go to is the olive wood factory. Anyone go there? I should have brought it. So there's this olive wood factory where, I mean, you get like various products made out of olive wood. The big things they're known for are things like welcome signs for doors. You know, they do like some little calligraphy. The other thing where all these, you know, yeshiva and seminary students get are the shtenders, which is like a little lectern thing that pops up. They, you know, do calligraphy in your name. And on the top bar, you know, they usually put on the Gita Bo Yomam V'Laila. You should teach them day and night. Now that right there is using a pasuk for decoration. Mine is actually blank. Like, almost like for that very reason. I said, you know, it's like, well, pasuk? It's like, nope. Because, you know, they're, I mean, the calligraphy that they're doing is actually a lot more akin to what's in a Sefer Torah than your typical block lettering.
That reminds me of Hadiah in Jerusalem, the jeweler that does the pasuk necklaces.
There you go. That would...
What? He's like, really from guy. And it's like so popular with like...
So I'm not that up in jewelry, but in theory, according to Rambam, it would be a problem. Now, he could say he has a heter for it, meaning some dispensation for it. Ah, couldn't see this. Oh, thank you. Ah, this is interesting. So this doesn't quite look blocky, right? It's kind of like etched
it's
in
like
there.
His own, like...
Yeah, sorry if you're listening, you can't see this. Right. Yeah, but it's... It looks more...
You're a girl, you know, Hadaya.
Or, yeah, well, I'm not, and I don't have... Yeah, and I never got it for anyone either. Cool. I mean, it happens to be really nice, but the truth is, for something like this, I would see... I mean, you can pass it around if anyone hasn't seen it. I'd have a serious question. Look, to me, it doesn't seem like what would be in a Sefer Torah. Like, it really just does seem more etched in to
so
decorate.
It's a matter of font, really. Like,
that's what the Rambam... Yeah. The Rambam makes that distinction. The question that would be is practically what counts today, like, that makes it Savashuri for the purposes of this, you know, this issue. So... I'm not going to tell you to burn that, you know, but when an artist, you know, but when an artist like come here and tells me like, how do I use, like, how do I integrate this verse in the design? My initial reaction is, you know what? Better not. Even though like, yeah, even though it does seem to be, the truth is, you know, based on the Gemara, it does seem to be at worst a rabbinic prohibition,
right?
Not biblical. Right. And we can be more lenient with the rabbinic prohibitions than the biblical. So I can say like, you know what? Don't do it because, you know, of all these issues. But if it's done, you know, it's not something you're going to throw a hissy fit about. If I go into, you know, the sukkah, right? People, the Seward Park sukkahs had a bunch of stuff there with verses on there. Yeah. I'm not going to burn down the sukkah. Right, you know, samach debecha gechav yitach sameach. There you go. Or just dot, 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 you know, yitach sameach, which are also not that great to do. Right? I'm not going to burn down the sukkah because, oh, you put up, like, you know what, if it's done... You know, there are worse things in the world, but, you know, these are at least some considerations, you know, that are so easy to overlook because people don't think it's wrong anymore because it's so common.
It's so common.
Right? Yeah. If I said, oh, you're not allowed to use a pasuk as a decoration, you'd
but
think I'm crazy.
But amongst, like, religious people, it's common. It's, like, a very...
It's done in, like Orthodox schools and camps. So you go, they make a sign for color war.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a pasuk on top and then some kind of thing you know, for water or fire. Or
but you also see the danger inherent of just relying on what people do, because you've got a huge distance. I speak about this in shul a lot, of, you know, the difference between, you know, what halacha is and what people do, and rarely are they the same. And often people assume what people do is, in fact, halacha, both in terms of permitting things that might be prohibited and prohibiting things which are completely permitted, right? But because people don't do them, it must be bad. If you're interested in learning more about that, come to the Sunday class. Because that's where we develop, that's where we're going through, you know, the halachic process. All right. So we got through making art, and at least one issue there in terms of what can be made and what can't be made. Some issues regarding verses. Last section, want to discuss matters of art appreciation, right? Because it's a, you know, pretty big deal. You know, we got a lot of artists here. Yeah. People like, you know. Yeah. So what are the laws?
I would ask something we talked about before.
Sure.
You can't write just a verse. You have to, unless you're going to write the entire
Sefer Torah.
Right.
Yeah.
But could that be interpreted that you would write it all eventually? You're going to write one verse and then the next verse the next day?
Based on the right thing of the Gemara, it's like, ve'im da'ato lahashlim mutar, that if your intention is to complete it, then you're okay. Now, it might take you a while. You know, and only you know what your real intention is. Because, look, if you weren't allowed to, you know, write, if you weren't allowed to write, you know, more than three letters, otherwise do the whole thing, then that would mean the only way you could ever write a Sefer Torah is in one sitting. Mm-hmm. And I don't know anyone who has that, who can do that. Right, even the best sofer needs to get up from time to time, right? So, but think about it. Otherwise, or even like if it just do all of Sefer Bereishit at once, right? That's still a huge task, right? So, what are you going to do? The fact that is, you're going to have to write verses or paragraphs in the Torah without completing it, because that's the only way you can write it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So this is Gemara Avodah Zarah 40b.
Okay, Mishnah. All images are prohibited because they are worshipped once a year.
So by images here, this refers to images of idolaters. Yeah. So but the implication here, it doesn't say Avodah Kochavim every single time because it's in Avodah Zarah, and just the context, assume that that is, it'll be explained a little bit later, but for now, yeah.
Such is the statement of Rabbi Meir. But the sages declare, an image is not prohibited except one that has a staff or bird or orb in its hand.
So when it says here image, I should mention the, you know, the word here is tselem. The translation here is sinsinos, which is image. It seems to me to be referring to like a three-dimensional. It's hard to say whether or not it's like a real three-dimensional thing or it's a two-dimensional thing. For the purpose, let's just say it's an image. Right. When it talks about statues, then it'll be a little bit clearer, but could in theory apply to paintings too, and you'll see in a bit why.
Rabban Simeon ben Gamaliel says, also any image which has anything in its hand is prohibited. Gemara, if they are worshipped once a year, what is the reason of the rabbis in allowing them to be used for a secular purpose, provided certain symbols are not in their hand? Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yosef said in the name of Rabbi Yohanan, in the place where Rabbi Meir lived, the heathens used to worship each image once a year. And since Rabbi Meir takes a minority into consideration, he decreed against the use of images in the other places on account of the place where they are worshipped.
So to explain what the implications are here, there is, right, a prohibition that if something is used for avodah zarah, something is used for idolatrous purposes, you are not allowed to get hana'ah from it. You are not allowed to derive benefit from it. So then the question is, well, you've got these things, you know, public things, are you allowed to derive benefit from it? Rav Meir said, well, you know, where he are, they used to worship them once a year, but if Rabbi Meir, as a Tana, one of the things that he is most known for is worrying about the minority. And not just minority, but if there was a non-zero probability of something, he'd worry about it. Meaning, even if it was a 1% chance, he'd be concerned about it. Sages.
I mean, you read that earlier on. Sorry.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Exactly. Could you take the next paragraph?
Rav Yehudah said in the name of Samuel, the teaching of the Mishnah refers to the royal statues, statues of kings which were reverenced by the populace. And not
that's not my typo. That's copied and pasted. Yeah. Whatever.
That's fine. Announced to ordinary idolatrous images. Rabba Ben?
Barbar Chana. The grandson of Chana, basically.
Okay. Barbar Chana said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, the teaching of the Mishnah only applies to these statues when they stand at the entrance of a city. Only such are prohibited by Rav Meir because they are erected in a conspicuous place to be worshipped.
Right, so there's a concern here about sort of probability. Right, if they're in a place where they're going to be worshipped, then they're forbidden. Otherwise, they seem to be okay. Right, we're not talking again here about statues that Jews made. You know, right. Which also see about whether or not you can derive any benefit from that. You know, but certainly would be prohibited. But here, non-Jew makes the stuff as long as it's not for idolatrous purposes. Right, right? Even though you can't make it, you can still get benefit from it. Right. Continue.
Rabba said, there is a difference of opinion with regard to statues in villages, but as for those which are in cities, all agree that they are permitted. What is the reason for their being permitted? They are made for ornamentation and not to be worshipped. But is there anyone who says that the images set up in villages are made merely for ornamentation? Surely those in villages were made to be worshipped! Exclamation point. Because villagers do not spend money on statues just as ornaments.
They don't have as much money for it.
Yeah,
you're a poor village. If you're going to buy a statue, you're going to get your money's worth out of it. You're going to pray to it. Yeah.
That's funny. If, however, Rabba's statement is quoted, it must be in this form. Rabba said, there is difference of opinion with regard to statues in cities. Since it is uncertain whether they are ornamental or for worship. But as for those in villages, all agree that they're prohibitive.
Right, so it seems that even if it's just an uncertainty, then we can be lenient. But once you're like sure that it's used for idolatrous purposes, no. You might recall we saw that a little bit earlier in Maimonides, where you know if it came from a place where it was usually like the rove majority. What was the line here? One of the sources where forms are permitted. It was in the Ramah. If one finds them, they are permitted aside from the sun and the moon. This is, in source number 4 here, in the Ramah, part of the Shulchan Aruch, where it says, if it's normal for idolaters to worship them, you know, this finding the picture of the sun and the moon and the stars, like, that's bad, mm-hmm. right? And buying the same thing, like, what is normal to be worshipped?
So, is it considered worship? I'm curious. Like, if there's, like, this happens all the time. Like, there's a statue that today, like, people like rub for luck or something like that. Is that considered worshipping?
Yeah, that's a much bigger question that'll handle. Take Rambam 7:6.
Okay. Images made by idolaters for art are permitted for benefit, but those made for idolatry are prohibited. How so? All images found in the villages are prohibited because the status quo assumption is that those images are made for idolatry. But those found in the city, if they are by the gates of the city, if there was in the statue a staff or bird or spear or sword or crown or ring, the assumption is those were made for idolatry and are those prohibited to derive benefit. But otherwise, the assumption is that they are only for decoration and are permitted.
So Rambam Paskin's basically it's not that it has to have one of those things as much as if it has one of those things, then it's used for idolatrous purposes, or at least it's a better indicator. In theory, if you know with absolute certainty that that was not the intention, right? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you could be able to be a little more lenient there. Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, if it doesn't have it, but you know it was used for idolatrous purposes, it's still prohibited. Now, your question, I think, is very well taken, because you can say, well, let's say there was a statue that was just made. When does it really become idolatrous? You know, that is a much... And then you have to get to what's really considered, you know... let's say you're on a college campus, right? So most have the superstition, like you rub, mm-hmm. like... there was one thing where... You never heard that?
In Maryland. You rub the nose.
And it's like all shiny. Like you can tell. Yep. Right. A lot of colleges have like these rituals. There's something like, I think even in Chicago with that. There's like a giant statue and like you rub a certain part of it allegedly for good luck. Mm-hmm. Does that make it an object of idol worship? I have the foggiest idea.
It seems like you'd be deriving benefit though from that. Because, like, otherwise, but what is deriving benefit from a statue otherwise? Like, just looking at it and saying,
that's another good question. Because, normally, like, when it talks about deriving benefit, it means...
Like, enjoying it is deriving benefit?
Well, I'll tell you this. Normally, like, deriving benefit can be, refers to eating, but very few people eat statues. Let's say you own it. Let's say somehow it comes into your possession. Are you allowed to sell it? Right? Okay. That would be deriving benefit. Okay. Would you be allowed to buy it and keep it in your house for decorative purposes? For that, we've got... I'll do the last one.
I'm just going to cut you off for just a second. What I was thinking when I asked, like, is that okay for rubbing it or anything like that, I was thinking of actually the bull down by Wall Street.
Right? Ah, there you go.
So people rub the bull or whatever it is, and in my spare time, I am a New York City tour guide. So if I am pointing out the bull on one of my tours, I'm getting paid for that tour, not only for that... Mm. But I'm getting paid to, in part, discuss a bull that people rub for luck.
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking.
I think you're fine. But that is an awesome question. Look, here's the thing. If I wanted to come up, if I wanted to, like, say that what you're doing is forbidden, that's kind of what I'd say.
Right.
But I think you're okay. You could also argue, if you're giving tours of the Wall Street area, it's like, well, commerce is idolatrous, and therefore, like, you can't do any building. And,
right. Fair enough.
So in terms of the personal only thing, here's Rambam Avodah Zarah 8:8. The objects of idolatry, which has, should be have, been nullified before it came to the hands of a Jew, it is permitted to derive benefit. For it says, the statues of their gods you must burn in fire, refers to when it comes into our hands, when they're acting with it as a divinity. But if it was nullified, it was permitted. In better English than what I was just able to squeeze into a box, it means this. You know, we in Jewish law have something, the word is called halal. Right? Usually it's bad. Like, chilul Shabbat means you desecrate the Sabbath. We have chulin, which means something that is unconsecrated meat, as opposed to things that are kodeshim offered in the temple. In a nutshell, the same rules apply to avodah zarah. Like, if there is a certain thing that was used for avodah zarah, according to Rambam, the avodah, the item can actually be batel. They can actually say, nafavat, yeah, this is no longer idolatrous, whatever. One example. I got this from Rabbi Moshe Tendler in Shir. He got a question once that someone picked up at a pawn shop a Catholic censer. Anyone know what the censer is? The censer is the ball of spice that you see swirling around, particularly at Midnight Mass. If you ever watch a clip of Midnight Mass, there's always a thing about, you know, swirling around this, like, giant spice ball. I apologize if there are any Catholics listening. That's the best I can describe it, and it's called a censer. So a guy got one of these at a pawn shop, and he wanted to turn it into a Ner Tamid, the light that hangs over the ark in a synagogue. Mm. Now, as Rav Tendler said, you don't ask why for such questions, but the question came up. And his answer was, yes, it is permitted. Even though it might have once been used for idolatrous purposes, or at least assuming Catholicism is a avodah zarah, and I don't think there's much of a stretch in saying that, once you find it in a pawn shop, you can pretty much assume that there's no avodah zarah attached to it anymore. It's now batel, in which case it's fine.
So, but it's a different word than, like, chilul Shabbat. Like,
you're right. He's using the term because they're not going to give the term. The opposite of chulin would be kadosh. And he's not going to use that term. Exactly, because if it's right, because the opposite of chol is kadosh, which is right. He's not going to speak about avodah zarah like that way. I use that term because it's the best analogy. Okay. Like, what does it mean to be mevatel? You know, something avodah zarah. Well, the closest that our parallel is going from kodesh to chol. Okay. Their parallel is avodah zarah to batel. Right. Okay. Practically, it's the same thing. But I wanted to use. Bingo. That's it. So if you go,
it's like people have shuls that used to be a church.
So then the question is, as long as it's still functioning as a church, like, and then it also gets a whole bunch of mess. But I'll even do you one better. Let me see what you think about this. One of my excursions in Chinatown. Anyone just go spaziering down Chinatown? Like, check. You really should, and check out the random stores. I saw a bigger than life size giant bronze Buddha on sale for $8,500. I have no idea how anyone would even schlep it out. No, but you're talking about, like, a store that's even narrower than this base midrash that has, I mean, it's almost the size of a recliner. I mean, yeah, I mean, sitting in it.
Have you ever been to any of the shrines in China?
I haven't been to a shrine. Going into there a place of avodas are going. Well, forget about whether Buddha's avodas are. That's a bigger question, right? So you know, but so I was thinking about, hey, like, let's say I wanted to buy this giant statue of a Buddha. I've got $8,500 of disposable income. All right, and you know, I'll just plop it down, giant bronze Buddha in my living room. You know, would I be able to use that? You know, depending on, well, there are actually different types of Buddhas. Like, you've got the Chinese Buddha that tends to be like thinner, point your head, and right. Indian Buddha that's a lot fatter. So, depending on, yeah, and that, you know, can get crazy complicated. Like, do you consider that as, you know, Batel? You know, if they're selling it in the store, right? Or do you make change? Like, so. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know,
it's like just the fact that they're selling it in like some crappy stores, like
right. On the other hand, you know, that very well, like, is that considered like worship material or
maybe
not?
They're selling it.
But it wasn't pawn. It's different in the sense that in the pawn shop, somebody had said, "Well, I don't need this. I don't want this."
Exactly. Uh huh.
I mean, they sell.
Now, in case anyone's wondering, I did not actually purchase this, and I have no intention of doing so. But yeah, so you'll have, so if it ever does come up, I think that's, you know, that is a wonderful point. Where you get the material, like where you get the stuff, like something I noticed years back, I wound up, this is weird. It was around Pesach time. It was Good Friday. I was on a date and wound up in the Christian quarter on Good Friday, which was a bit of a trip and one of the wackiest dates I've ever been on. That was also the only one we went on, whatever. So one of the things that I noticed, like going down the Christian quarter, is, you remember I mentioned the olive wood stuff? Mm-hmm. So I saw like there were people who were selling olive wood Jesus heads. You know, it must have been like at least, you know, a foot or so tall. And I was like, wow, you know, we're not the only ones who capitalize in our religion, you know, and just like selling various stuff. Right? Now, I would probably say if you're getting it in the Christian quarter, odds are, you know, it's done for more religious purposes because the people are going to pass by there. Also, another fascinating question about walking in the Christian quarter on Good Friday when everyone's doing the Stations of the Cross. Really, wow. Really wacky. Mm-hmm. Right? But as, you know, if you pick it up in, say, you know, the gift shop of the Met, assuming they sell such things, would that be different? Because mm-hmm. it was the indicator that, well, if, you know, they're picking it up, is that a secular purpose or a religious purpose? I think that's a wonderful distinction. I would recommend against it, though, for a whole bunch of other reasons. You know, people, like, more of propriety reasons about Jews only, you know, wooden Jesus heads. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It, but not something that could be used, like, as a near town meet or didn't have a face on it or, like...
Well, yeah, I mean, unless you set the thing, hollow it out and set it on fire. But even if you did that, people would still look at you really, really funny. You know, this... yes, on top of your Aron Kodesh, you have an illuminated Jesus head. It just doesn't seem appropriate, you know, even if, no, like, even if, like, really hard, could it be permitted? Let's say it is. You know, just don't do it. All right, so to sum up everything quickly, is that even something like art does have a whole lot of laws attached. Sculpture in particular is very complicated. Doing verses are complicated. Even owning and appreciating certain art is going to be complicated. Mm. Like, has anyone been here to the cloisters?
Yeah.
A while ago.
All right, so...
That's like the really old, it's like really old art, right? Like, it's like
medieval art. And, yeah. So I went there, you know, a friend of mine who was a convert, actually wanted to go, like, took two steps in and just felt so uncomfortable and left. Mm-hmm. You know, can even argue about, like, entering there and deriving benefit from stuff. But at that point, you could, like, would you say even something like, I don't even know how big is it? Look like a 50-foot...
But it's appreciation benefit. I just, that's what I'm not clear about. Because, like, I am mm-hmm. a huge art appreciator, and I appreciate a lot of art, and I see art, but it's not...
Yeah,
I'm not using it for my...
It's hard to quantify. It's much easier to say, well, hana'a means... you know, eating, right? Which is how it normally comes up, because that's tangible. Buying and selling, mm-hmm. giving it to a friend, mm-hmm. right, as a gift. Those could be hana'a. But just passing by and saying, hey, that looked pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Even if it's used for avodas, it's much harder to really, like, have that line of what... Because for most people, if you're artistically inclined, it's just a reaction, right?
Yeah. But also, I think, like... Even if you're a religious person and you see religious art, like, even if it's not your religion, I think there's a certain level of, like, appreciating because you relate with the fact that this person, like, this artist who, like, felt a connection with God or, like, even if it's not the way you would practice, like, because a Jew isn't allowed to make the kind of things that this person might have made, Christian art, medieval art, whatever it is, pagan art. like in the African section of the Met, where it used to be the primitive museum, and in mm-hmm. the '70s, and they moved the whole collection to the Met in like 1974, and it's all primitive, all African, all.
Well, you clearly have this culture, you know, attunement. There are quite a few people who are not as sophisticated.
Well, I mean, I look at that art and I think, like, well, yes, like, they were much simpler. Like, their whole world was about this god of rain, because their whole entire existence depended on rain. So, like, that was the focus of their entire culture. Like, I can appreciate that. Obviously, my life has nothing to do with that. But, like, appreciating it and understanding it is, like...
I hear the distinction.
Educational. Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah.
Let me throw out another question for you. What about a picture? Because let's say you're an art historian. Rarely does an art historian have the budget to hit up all of the, you know, classic places that they're studying, right? They have to base it on images, right? Pictures, you know, fancy books, stuff online. What would you say? How would that fit in all this?
Like, is it deriving benefit to see a picture?
Yeah, meaning how it based on yeah. If you see a facsimile of the actual item, what do you think?
Hmm. Well, no, because Rambam said that it doesn't matter. The replication is okay. That's mutar. Mm-hmm. Didn't he write that? You can't make the actual.
Well, that's in terms of what you're making, right? But the thing that you're making, the thing that you're making with your digital reproduction. Right?
But you are making that. You are making a picture.
But it would also be something new. Meaning, if the problem is this item of idolatry, right? Down the block, we have Our Lady of Sorrows. And periodically, you'll actually see a bunch of people, like, on the sidewalk praying to the statue. Right? You take a picture of that statue, no one's praying to that picture. Right? So it would not have... I mean, I don't think it would have that same rules about, say, Hana'a. So if you've got a giant... If you've got, say, a big book of Catholic art, of medieval Catholic art, I don't think we'd fall under that same category as actually having a giant Norman window in your apartment
like
that was done initially.
Has all that, like, there's so much controversy about Jews going to see the Sistine Chapel.
That's something else. That is a separate issue.
Is it?
That involves entering a church.
Oh, okay.
Entering a church is halakhically problematic. Right. Specifically, you're not allowed to enter a place that's designated for Avodah Zarah. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef had a response, I'm forgetting on the date about this, of a cantor that used to go to a church to pick up tunes to use for the high holidays. And he said that was outright forbidden. Not the use of the tunes, but the fact that he went into the church. So, and it would mean specifically going into the sanctuary. Like, I mean, elections are coming up soon. So if someone, like, it's not uncommon to vote, like, if your local voting station in suburbia is going to be in a church, but it's not in the sanctuary, it's going to be in one of the other rooms. Mm-hmm. That would be permitted because those rooms aren't an issue. I did have that question when I was in the Christian quarter during the Stations of the Cross.
Right.
Because and afterwards I asked my father's teacher, like, what's the deal? Because this seems to be like a place of their worship. And he said, well, on Good Friday, it would be a problem. Like, whenever they actually do the Stations of the Cross as their official ritual, that's bad. In the future, don't. So that was an interesting halachic question that came up far too late for me to do anything about. but yes, entering churches, and that's also why, you know, one of the popular question I get, or used to get, was Buddhist temples. Like, could you go into a meditation center? And then you have to get into the question is that a place that's designated for Avodah Zarah?
Right.
But in order to answer that, you have to know what is the religion that is being practiced there. Like, according to Maimonides, Islam would not be Avodah Zarah, so there wouldn't be a problem entering a mosque under the same rules. Mm-hmm. Buddhism is incredibly complicated because it depends where Buddhism is. There's so many different strains of it. So it really depends which one.
Huh.
If anyone's interested, I can add that to the list about the Jewish laws of Buddhism, if anyone's interested, but let me know. All right. So thank you all very much. We got class again this Sunday and next week. See you then.